Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This is our second day on the air on KGUA on the Mendocino Coast, and we'd like to wish our new listeners a very warm welcome. Today we are talking about California's cap and trade program. It's been extended until 2030. The program requires oil refineries, food processors, power plants, and other facilities to buy permits to release greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. Cap and trade has divided some environmentalists. Environment Defense Fund says California's cap and trade program addresses local air pollution and pushes California businesses toward a cleaner economy. Today we're joined by Quentin Foster, director of Environmental Defense Fund's Global Climate Program, a nonprofit focused on environmental justice. And Quentin Foster joins us from Sacramento. Hi, Quentin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. You also have the organization Food and Water Watch, which says the bill, which was heavily influenced by the oil and gas industry, allows polluters to simply pay a fee to continue polluting the planet. Adam Scow is California director at Food and Water Watch, a nonprofit that advocates for healthy and affordable food and clean drinking water. And Adam joins us in studio. Hi, Adam. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
Good morning. All right, before we get into the debate around cap and trade, let's talk about what this actually does. And I gave a very simple explanation. The program will require oil refineries like Chevron, for example, or food processors or power plants to buy permits to release greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. Just to give people basic information, Adam, what else does the cap and trade program do?
Well, sure. The cap and trade program was implemented in 2012 and 2013 here in California. And cap and trade, I think there's two points we want to make about this bill. One are the problems with cap and trade overall, and then specifically why this bill is such a bad version of cap and trade.
And before we do that, though, Can you just talk about how the program works?
Sure. Well, yeah. As you said, cap and trade is allowed to give polluters flexibility towards addressing their pollution reductions. In California, we have a law in the books that says polluters have to reduce their pollution by 40% by 2030. And the question is, will the state actually make them do that, or will they be given carrots and sticks, incentives to do that? And cap and trade says, well, you all get a budget to pollute. You're allowed to pollute, turn a certain amount. And if you exceed that, well, you can do that. You just have to pay more money into a fund. And so a fund is created, which has been used to fund certain kinds of programs, some of them good, some of them questionable. And as you can see, one of the problems with it is that it's creating a dependence on funding from pollution. When we feel at this point in the climate crisis, we need to be rapidly drawing down our pollution emissions if we're going to have a stable climate.
Quentin, what would you add to that? Just basics on how the cap and trade program actually works.
I think it's important to note that overall, since the facilitation of the cap and trade program, greenhouse gas emissions have in fact decreased every year since its implementation, and the state is in fact on track to meet its original 2020 target. And so the continuation of this program is the best way to ensure that we reach, as Adam stated, the goal in 2030 of 40% greenhouse gas reduction levels by 1990 levels before the year 2030. And so seeing as how the cap and trade program has helped facilitate an acceleration, in fact, we're ahead of schedule in meeting our 2020 goals, it would make sense to continue a program that has a history of actually helping to facilitate.
Well, we're going to get into the details in just a couple minutes, but I wanted to give listeners just an overview of how this program works. So, Quentin, do you have anything to add just about the basics of cap and trade?
Sure. Let's refer to the bill that Adam just suggested, which is AB 398, the bill that just extended the cap and trade program beyond the year 2020. What the bill does is it does maintain the environmental integrity of California's cap on emissions, which is critically important. Introduces a price ceiling on allowances that allows the Air Board to provide greater certainty on cost. Done poorly, this ceiling would put environmental outcomes at risk. So that's number one, is the preservation of the environmental integrity of the program. What it also does is it extends the economic benefits of California's cap and trade program, and we can certainly get into that a little bit more further in the discussion, but I think it's important to note that while the program has been, in fact, in implementation, it has added over 1 million jobs since it was first launched in 2013. And the bill continues to provide further provisions to develop a green workforce for a growing green economy. And so it's notable that the acceleration and continuation of this program has actually done a great deal in terms of benefiting the California economy. And it's important to make sure that we continue that trajectory moving forward.
And that is Quentin Foster with the Environmental Defense Fund. We're also joined by Adam Scow with Food and Water Watch. And now I would like to welcome Judson True to the show. Judson is Chief of Staff for California Assembly Member David Chu, who also supports the extension of the program. Hi, Judson. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. It's good to be on with everybody.
Good morning. Why does Assembly Member David Chu support California's cap and trade program?
Well, let me just take a step back and talk about where we were as a state this year as we looked at the governor's climate proposals and some of them from our assembly members. I think everybody knows that at the national level, we're seeing an incredible stepping away from the fact that climate change is even real. In fact, just yesterday, the New York Times reported that there's an internal report from a number of federal scientists that call out the reality of climate change and that it's affecting the United States right now. And it's not even clear whether the Trump administration is going to let this become public. And of course, a few months ago, Trump moved away and is in the process of taking the United States out of the Paris Climate Accords. So Governor Brown is looking at that reality and saying California has to show another path, that the United States and the largest state in the country can follow another path. So that's really where we were this year. Now, Assemblymember Chu, was very happy to support a stronger cap-and-trade proposal that was before the Assembly in late May and early June, but unfortunately that one wasn't able to get the votes, and so Governor Brown was negotiating with the leadership in both the legislature, the legislative bodies, the Senate and the Assembly, as well as all the different stakeholders from the environmental community to business, and this is where we ended up with AB 398 and a companion measure around air pollution, AB 617. And Assemblymember Chu, while had some serious concerns about some giveaways to the oil industry in the cap-and-trade bill, but ultimately decided that California has to set an example by extending cap-and-trade and moving us toward a future where we address climate change and don't just stick our head in the sand and pretend it's not real. So ultimately, while there were some hesitations about some provisions in the bill, I mean, it was a deal. The bill is a deal, like a lot of legislation. But ultimately, he decided that it was what was best for the future of Californians.
And Judson, how transparent was this process? A number of environmental justice groups said that they did not have a seat at the table. And according to E&E News, 7 oil companies and the petroleum trade group Western States Petroleum Association doled out about $34 million to have their voice heard when it comes to cap and trade. And Brent Newell with the Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment said that oil lobbyists were surrounding legislators' offices leading up to the unveiling of this bill. He named a lot of former Democrats who are now lobbyists for companies like Chevron, for example.
Well, as working for the assembly member from San Francisco, as you can imagine, the oil industry doesn't have a whole lot to do with us. We're not have regular communications with them and did not get lobbied by them on the bill. But I think it's really unfortunate that the environmental justice community was unhappy with both the process and the outcome. And I know on behalf of Assembly Member Chu, we're committed to continuing to work with CEHA and other EJ advocates on other, other directions that California can go in the future. I do think that, not speaking for Governor Brown, but he basically looked at the math in the legislature and saw that the assembly in particular could not get the votes on its own. So he realized that needing a 2/3 vote, he wanted to see this cap and trade extended. And so he looked at ways to cut deals with some of the Republicans. And luckily, I think in some ways in California, while we disagree with even the California Republicans on most issues, at least a small group of them were not in just blatant denial of the reality of climate change and the impact of global warming on our state. So the governor was able to, find ways, working with the legislative leadership to get them on board. The 2/3 threshold in the legislature to secure cap and trade or any revenue measures or anything that's of this magnitude is a really significant hurdle that we had to overcome. And I think when you see the gridlock in Washington, which I think at this point is welcome considering what they want to do, it's just a reminder of how impressive it is that we're able to accomplish that. And if I could say one thing about another issue.
You know, actually, Judson, yeah, sorry, I know we have to let you go in about 4 minutes. So I just want to ask Adam Scow with Food and Water Watch to talk about some of the main concerns that Food and Water Watch and other environmental justice groups have with the cap and trade program.
Well, sure, absolutely. Over 50 of California's leading environmental groups oppose this bill, Food and Water Watch, Sierra Club, 350, and all of the frontline community groups, the environmental justice groups, oppose the bill. There's three main provisions that we found most offensive. One was the gross number of allowances that allow the industry to continue polluting, which will actually jeopardize our pollution reduction goals. Number two,
Can you just talk about how that works, the number of allowances?
So, I mean, yeah, the basic theory of cap and trade is that polluters get a budget for allowances, and every year those allowances should be drawn down a little bit so they're actually reducing their pollution. The program is so new in California, we don't have any evidence that has actually worked. And with this bill, we don't think it's going to work. If you look at coal-fired-powered plants in the East Coast, cap and trade, talking about Republicans, this was actually the Republican response to real environmental regulations. Cap and trade was the industry compromise it always has been. And at its best, cap and trade can slowly reduce pollution. We think that is the totally wrong approach to dealing with the climate crisis right now.
Who sets the number of allowances?
It is a California Air Resources Board. However, this bill prescribes some of these numbers, allowing old allowances to be put into play, allowing for an overabundance of the oil and gas industry to have some flexibility there. Our local air board, the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, has been looking into placing its own caps on emissions here in the Bay Area. We have five enormous refineries in the East Bay. They are now prohibited from doing so from this legislation.
So Judson, can you comment on this concern?
Yeah, I think that the provision that Adam just mentioned around the air quality management districts was really one of the biggest concerns that Assemblymember Chu had with the proposal, and just frankly was something that he had to just get over in order to be able to vote for this extension, because it's not something that on its own he would ever support. So, you know, we're hopeful that AB 617, the air pollution measure I mentioned, will provide some additional tools for local communities to take on localized sources of pollution like the refineries, and that this provision is only going to affect the larger kind of greenhouse gas issues. But it's a huge concern. I mean, no one wants to pretend that this cap and trade bill was perfect, but I think that when you look at on balance whether California was going to continue its environmental leadership or whether we were going to take a step back and not extend cap and trade at the same time that you see Trump pulling out of Paris, I think that would have been a much worse outcome for the environment and for future generations.
Adam?
Well, I mean, the reality is that California does not need cap and trade. Cap and trade has been forced down our throat from the governor and the legislature and big business, which has wanted to support cap and trade because they have opposed the real solution that we need in California, which is the Air Resources Board to mandate real reductions. It's actually a much more simple a way to deal with pollution is to actually force the Chevron refinery to reduce its pollution by 40% at the source. There's no gimmicks. There's no pay to pollute. There's no loopholes. And actually, in a very insidious way, Governor Brown threatened the legislature and big business, and he actually predicted the oil and gas industry would support this deal because he threatened to actually make them reduce their pollution. I saw this in committee live. And so we can talk about Trump, and obviously Trump is horrible and off the cliff on this issue, but that is no excuse for bad policy in California. If Trump is trying to let the oil and gas industry avoid any regulation, it seems Governor Brown is happy to let them write the regulations here in California. And that is exactly what he did with the fracking issue of several years ago as well, when he had allowed fracking to continue in California.
Rose, can I jump in here?
Quentin, I actually have to let Judson go. He has to leave at 10:20.
Just a minute if Quentin wants to,
sure.
On behalf of some of the other environmental groups that I know supported this extension, even though they didn't like the provisions, the same ones we didn't like.
All right, go ahead, Quentin.
So two points to that, and I have a great deal of respect for Food and Water Watch and really appreciate the work that Adam and that his organization does on behalf of Californians to make sure that we do have clean food and clean water and that those issues are addressed. But I do have to push back on this notion somehow that this is, you know, was nefarious in terms of its deal-making. Let's take a trip back down memory lane here. You know, in 2006, when AB 32 was enacted, the oil and gas lobby vehemently opposed cap and trade, launched millions of dollars to help bring that policy down. Okay, the Cal Chamber launched a court case to challenge the legality of the program in 2006. That court case wasn't decided until today. In addition to that, there were these threats of economic doom centered on the passage of AB 32. What do we see today? Not only have those theories and ideas been debunked, but we've seen a climate policy that has moved in a direction in which it was designed to do, to drive emission reductions of greenhouse gas pollutants, which has happened. And now we have those same industries that were vehemently opposing climate legislation in California, a cap and trade policy that does take into effect cost feasibility and cost containment with regards to emissions reductions, now supporting the very same policy they oppose. So even they have now come around to understanding and realizing that, yes, if California is going to continue its aggressive stance on climate policy, continue to be the leader, and continue to do it in a way that works for the California economy, let's not forget now, we have grown to the sixth largest economy in the world. While this policy has facilitated aggressive climate change actions since it's been enacted, now these same industries are at the table not only supporting it, but asking for it. I think that's a huge shift that cannot be understated in terms of how we have changed the table around, the pieces on the table around, to be supportive of California moving forward to address a global climate issue. One other thing I'd like to underscore very quickly is somehow the ability to compromise seems absent from a lot of our political arenas today. I do like the fact that Judson brought up what is happening in Washington, D.C. with the Trump administration. I do not think that we can understate that or undervalue the significance of what is being done there and how important it was for California to show the way, to say that, you know what, we do have people from different parts of the aisle on this issue with very different perspectives from very different regions of the state who can come together and set aside some of those ideological differences to find a deal, to find a compromise that continues to move California forward in the right way. This not only had national implications, but global implications. So it was very important for the legislators here to step out of their comfort zone, if you will, in some of the ideological perspective and look at the greater good and what we are really trying to accomplish, which is
and Quentin,
addressing climate change.
I have to let Judson go. Judson, before I let you go, Adam was talking about forcing refineries to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Do you know if Assemblymember Chu supports a plan like that, or do the progressive Democrats support a plan like that?
Yeah, I think that if it was up to the progressive Democrats, we would see that pollution directly reduced. But I think that while the regulators may have some ability to do that, the backlash with the economy and other issues might be, you know, too significant. Quentin spoke to some of that. The one other thing I wanted to add before I go is that Assemblymember Chu, as chair of the Assembly Housing Committee, has been focused on affordable housing this year as an issue, and that was something that he brought up directly with Governor Brown over the course of the conversations around cap and trade. And we hope when we come back in the session the week of August 21st that we'll be able to address housing, because housing and transportation are also tremendous environmental issues, and in fact our land use patterns and where housing is built and how people travel to and from work is one of the biggest contributors to greenhouse gas emissions in the state. And so that was something that I really wanted to get in that's incredibly important to Assemblymember Chu, and I think we have a lot of support from the environmental justice community on that issue, and appreciate that, and look forward to continuing to work on other climate issues with folks as well.
All right. Well, Justin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, and this is a great discussion.
That is Judson True, Chief of Staff for California Assemblymember David Chu, who supports the extension of the cap and trade program. Assemblymember Chu represents San Francisco. Today we are talking about cap and trade. It's a program that requires oil refineries, power plants, food processors, and other facilities to buy permits to release greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. It has now been extended until the year 2030. And if you have any questions or comments about cap and trade, where do you stand on this issue? If you work for an environmental group, where do you stand? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet at yourcallradio. Quinton Foster is director of Environmental Defense Fund's Global Climate Program. They believe that the cap and trade program addresses local air pollution and pushes California businesses toward a cleaner economy. Adam Scow is California director at Food and Water Watch. They say that the bill, which was heavily influenced by the oil and gas industry, allows polluters to simply pay a fee to continue polluting the planet. We have an email from Mark who says, given that greenhouse gases are raping the planet, cap and trade makes about as much sense as allowing rapists to buy rape permits. The mere thought that we sell allowances for destructive behavior is chilling. Quinton, how would you respond to Mark?
Well, I certainly think that his analogy there is a little hyperbolic. I wouldn't compare cap and trade to a rapist. Look, the fact of the matter is there are a lot of good people, both in environmental organizations within that California Air Resources Board, that care a great deal about how we reduce greenhouse gas emissions and address climate change. If it were so simple to just go in and create a policy that wouldn't have any negative externalities as it relates to economic development, economic growth, GDP growth, if it was that simple to produce a policy that wouldn't even have further economic restrictions or hardships in many of the communities that are vulnerable, that have borne the brunt of these issues for quite some time, then certainly if there was a silver bullet, we would take it. The fact of the matter is that just isn't the case. There are a lot of industries, there are a lot of stakeholders who are involved in this. And so when you are creating policy that has very ambitious goals, like what we just passed last year in SB 32 that calls for that 40% threshold to be reached by the year 2030, then you have to take into account how those other industries are going to be affected. You have to take into account what the economic opportunities are and where the risks are when you're trying to have such ambitious climate policy or policies that address those issues. Cap and trade is the policy that is the least cost effective way to be able to do that, to be able to incentivize these industries that for no other reason than the policy itself would seek to do things to change their behavior in terms of their emissions and how they go about doing business. And in fact, we are seeing that happen. Now, in a perfect world, we would love to see that happen much more quickly. But the fact of the matter is that just isn't the case.
All right, Quinton, let me get a response from Adam. We have to go to break in just a minute. Quinton's talking about economic benefits and how this would affect the economy. How do you respond to that argument, Adam?
Well, we need to reduce pollution, and the primary culprit of greenhouse gas pollution is the oil and gas industry, and we need to take them on. We need to phase them out. We need to replace those workers with jobs, and that's an absolute critical need, no question about it. But I don't buy the argument that phasing out fossil fuels is going to hurt every business in California and put everybody out of business. We have these doomsday scenarios. And in fact, we're already seeing the benefits of renewable energy. California is a leader in renewable energy and energy efficiency, and those programs have been very successful, have nothing to do with cap and trade. With respect to greenhouse gas reductions, as a state, as a country, as a world, we have to rapidly get off of fossil fuels and stop pumping carbon dioxide and methane in the air if we're going to have a shot at keeping this planet a safe, livable place. Cap and trade is not going to do it. A compromise with the oil and gas industry is totally the wrong approach. We need government to work for people here. As George Washington said, if men were angels, we wouldn't need government. Well, government here needs to be regulating and taking on the fossil fuel industry.
Adam Scow is California Director with Food and Water Watch, a nonprofit that advocates for healthy food and clean drinking water. They say that the cap and trade bill, which was heavily influenced by the oil and gas industry, allows polluters to pay a fee to continue polluting the planet. We're also joined by Quentin Foster, Director of the Environmental Defense Fund's Global Climate Program. They say the program addresses local air pollution. This was a huge concern of environmental justice groups. They also say that it pushes California businesses toward a cleaner economy. What do you think? What are your thoughts on cap and trade? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. If you get a busy signal, you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can leave a comment at the show's website, set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about a recent investigation by the East Bay Express that looked at for-profit ambulance services and what they mean for the future of emergency health care. This is happening in the Bay Area and now across the country. And a lot of people are wondering, who will be there when I call 911? That's tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about California's cap and trade program, which has been extended until 2030. And it requires oil refineries and other facilities, like Chevron, for example, to buy permits to release greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. And this has divided a lot of environmentalists. Environmental Defense Fund says that it addresses local air pollution. And we're joined today by Quentin Foster, director of the Environmental Defense Fund's Global Climate Action. And then you've got Food and Water Watch. They say that the bill allows polluters to simply pay a fee and then continue polluting. And Adam Scow is California director with Food and Water Watch. We've got full lines. A lot of people want to weigh in on this. So let's hear from Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I wanted to ask anyone on the panel what they think. First of all, I oppose this bill. I'm in favor of all the positions that Food and Water Watch is putting forward. But I wanted to ask anyone what the difference would be between polluters purchasing to pollute versus getting fined if they did.
Okay, Adam?
I don't think that it's a huge difference. And the one of the political problems and why there was so much Kool-Aid in Sacramento about cap and trade is because of the money generated from the allowances or the fines. When you create a revenue stream that is very attractive to many politicians and programs, they got Republican in support by promising money for ag programs in the Valley. And this is a very dangerous way of approaching pollution policy. If we're going to create revenue streams based on the continued allowance of pollution, when we should instead be getting off of fossil fuels, this is the kind of political problems we create. Now, California is a leader in renewable energy, no question about it, but we still have the second highest overall emissions in the country after Texas, and we have some of the worst air quality in the Central Valley and in Southern California, where thousands of people die every year because of dirty air. And so there's no if we're going to address that honestly, the pollution has to be reduced dramatically.
Eight of the 10 cities with the worst air pollution in the country are in the state of California. In the Los Angeles area, about 1,341 people are estimated to die every year because of bad air. 1,341.
Yes, and thousands more get chronically sick as well. And for those communities who live near these refineries and these power plants in low-income areas, their health problems are even worse.
Quentin, would you like to respond?
Yeah, I would just say that, overall, I mean, what Adam, or I'm sorry, what our colleague here, Adam, said about renewable energy is true. In fact, we definitely want to see an acceleration of renewable energy, and we definitely want to see those emissions come down. But let's not kid ourselves here. A large portion of that pollution comes from the transportation sector, light duty and heavy vehicles. And so if we are going to draw the investments and draw the revenue that is critical to create the technologies and advance the differences in our portfolio as it relates to fuels, create alternative fuels, then this program has done and continues to be an important part of that toolbox to help drive that ingenuity and that investment capital that's necessary to provide the necessary revenue to support the R&D and support some of those ingenuities that we need moving forward. For example, the low carbon fuel standard, which is a complement with the cap and trade program, is further strengthened because of the cap and cap and trade. And so we're seeing that program have a great benefit and a great effect in terms of diversifying those alternative fuels that are critical, as Adam stated, to getting off of fossil fuels. We absolutely agree, and we absolutely want to see an acceleration of that and see us drive toward that, pun intended, to make sure that we are getting cleaner air from the transportation sector. But you do need a series of tools in order to be able to address these issues in a way that provides the best outcomes necessary. And cap and trade is one of many tools that helps to enforce and drive that kind of technology ingenuity and raise that revenue, address that, or draw that capital into California to help accelerate that and move that forward. And there are programs that the ARB runs that are addressed at trying to clean up diesel, clean up freight, clean up light-duty vehicles, get electrification of the transportation sector accelerated by getting electric vehicles on the road. Those are all programs that right now the ARB is facilitating, and part and parcel, a lot of it is due because of the funding that is coming from or being generated from the cap and trade revenue.
And on that point, according to the California Air Resources Board, since 2013, $1.2 billion has been generated and allocated to various projects. Who decides how this money is spent, Adam? Is this a transparent process?
That's a great question. My understanding is the State Air Resources Board has a big role to play in it, and some of it, a good chunk of that money has been promised for the high-speed rail project, which has somewhat of an uncertain future right now, but that has been the biggest single chunk of money for a specific project. And there's no question we need to be moving towards public transportation, and we need to electrify our transportation. And in our estimation, the state should be mandating that. We shouldn't be waiting for certain Wall Street investment portfolios to decide to do so. The best way to make it happen is for the state to mandate it, and industry will follow. And you see that with a lot of car companies. They're making rapid progress and could be making much more rapid progress. There's a great film called Who Killed the Electric Car that talked about that progress being slowed 20 years ago by the auto industry. So if the state were to really step up and say, yes, we need to electrify our transportation, we need to get our emissions down as close to zero as possible with some reasonable allowances, we could do great things. So we need to be doing much more.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Ruthann. Let's go next to Michael in Berkeley. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. Thank you for the show. I have two comments. I love the comment just made that a lot of the money from the corporations who want cap and trade is going to go toward the electrification, this rail thing that Jerry Brown wants. So, aha, it's going to fund his political agenda. And forget about coming down heavy on corporations. I just want to say, if you look at the political pyramid in California, Senator Feinstein is one of the biggest proponents of cap and trade, has been for years, and it just happens that her political nephew, Jerry Brown, is also for it. Last comment, Rose. Let's look at the track record of cap and trade in Europe. In the last century, in the 80s and 90s, a little bit into this century, used by the EU, a total failure. No cap and trade in Europe, a total failure in terms of reducing emissions. Vote out Dianne Feinstein. Let Jerry Brown know he's got a job to do with corporations, and let's clean up the air.
Well, thank you for that. Quentin, what about the environmental justice groups who expressed opposition to this bill and were very angry about the fact that they didn't have a seat at the table. The American Lung Association has a list of all of the oil lobbying. $36 million was spent between 2015 and 2016, about $50,000 per day. What about the influence that the oil and gas lobby have in Sacramento and had on this bill?
Right. So if I can touch on one point before I answer that question, Rose, just real quickly, going back to the acceleration of the transportation sector, and Adam was saying that the state should mandate it. It's important to note that a couple of bills a couple of years ago, one authored by Senate President Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon and another by Senator Ricardo Lara, did in fact get signed into law, and those are mandates from the government in terms of moving forward with getting up to over a million light-duty and heavy-duty vehicles transformed on the road to provide some of that environmental relief. So there is a mandate in place, and so the Air Resources Board is trying to meet that mandate with many of the programs that I touched upon earlier that is receiving some of its funding from the Cap and Trade program. Now, in answer to your second question, it is without doubt, it is true that the oil companies and a lot of the industries we don't particularly agree with or support do per capita have dollar for dollar much more influence when it comes to being able to target or get their message out in terms of what's important to them and their constituencies. But what I will say is that in spite of that, here's a few things that has happened over the past couple of years, right? Number one, the environmental community has not only come together but worked very hard, especially last year, to pass a bill that the oil company, with all their influence, with all their lobbyists, with all their money, sought to defeat and tear down, and that was SB 32. And we saw the culmination of that coalition work together to move the ball forward to make sure that that 40% threshold that is now state law that we have to meet by the year 2030 was in fact enacted and signed into law. And we beat back the oil industries in order to move the ball forward there. It is also true that there are things, as your earlier guest mentioned, who's the chief of staff for Assemblymember Chu, stated that there were things in this bill that even we as an environmental organization did not like. However, given the politics and given the fact that we had to pass this bill with a two-thirds threshold, which meant you needed to have some moderate Democrats and some Republican support in order to pass the legislation, and not just this one, but in order to get the majority of votes, 41, for the passage of AB 617, it was critical to come to the table and understand that there were going to be compromises made. But for our vantage point, what was important to us was to maintain the environmental integrity of both AB 398 and also to make certain that the assurances of 617 was substantial enough in order to satisfy some of the critiques and some of the concerns brought by our environmental justice colleagues. And that also is very important to note, given the political reality with which we had to deal with, that we were able to move forward a bill, an air quality bill, that short of being included in this conversation would not have received the 41 votes necessary to move it.
All right, so on that point, and sorry to cut you off, Quentin, but we have a bunch of callers waiting to get into the conversation. Adam, Quentin keeps talking about compromise. If you're not going to compromise with these moderate Dems and some of these Republicans in Sacramento, you're not going to get any of this passed.
And that would have been better. See, the good news is that we passed a bill last year. Quentin is right about SB 32. That was a good piece of legislation. Everybody was on the same side.
And remind us what that did.
And that is the 40% greenhouse gas reduction goal, which is a good start. We think it should be stronger, by the ways, but it's a good start by 2030. Everybody was on the same side. But the oil companies got their wish this year. Now they have a big loophole. Now they have a pay-to-pollute scheme. Now they have a ton of allowances to pollute. Now the local air districts can't regulate their greenhouse gas emissions. And we forgot to mention this, the big utility corporations, in exchange for paying fees, are getting a tax break. PG&E, SoCal Edison, and Sempra Gas all were enthusiastically – the PG&E lobbyists said, we enthusiastically support this bill in committee. So we did not need to pass a bill this year. It would have been better to pass no bill and let the Air Board reduce pollution at the source. but Brown and big business didn't want to go that way.
Because, again, according to the San Jose Merc, a big change is that this bill stops the Bay Area Quality Management District from setting new limits on greenhouse gases from companies like Shell and Chevron. And Tom Addison, a senior policy advisor for the Bay Area District, said, "We find it painful to be in a position where we're having to oppose a goal that we support so strongly."
It was nice to see the Air Quality Management District side with us and the frontline groups in opposing this bill.
What about that, Quentin, just briefly?
Well, that was a provision that we necessarily didn't agree with as well. But it's also important to note that that was relatively only focused on CO2. And so CO2 is already being regulated at the Air Resources Board. What the provision did not do is it does not prohibit the air districts from further taking into account addressing criteria and toxic pollutants, which, by the way, are the vast majority of pollutants that contribute to the adverse health impacts from which with which many of these communities are burdened with and deal with. And so we felt that while it wasn't a provision that we necessarily appreciated or we supported, we did feel that the fact of the matter is the Air Resources Board is already regulating CO2. And so as long as those air districts can continue to put provisions out there and continue to address those local pollutants, those criteria and toxic pollutants, which, by the way, may also add in terms of reduction in GHGs and still be able to avoid lawsuits from these companies prohibiting them from doing that, we felt that it was okay to support that bill even with that provision included.
Quentin Foster is director of the Environmental Defense Fund's Global Climate Program. They believe that California's cap and trade program addresses local air pollution and pushes the state's businesses toward a cleaner economy. Adam Scow is California director with Food and Water Watch. They say that the bill, which was heavily influenced by the oil and gas industry, allows polluters to simply pay a fee to continue polluting the planet. And California's cap and trade program has been extended until the year 2030. And let's go next to Mark in Berkeley. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. The four districts in California with the highest child asthma are in those four districts below the Richmond Refinery, down through Berkeley where the asphalt and the casting plant is, into Oakland where the container facility with those long line of diesel trucks just idling all day long. And we've seen members of the Air Board go before the Zoning Adjustment Board and tell them that it's the highway, it's the railroad. But we need to understand that the representatives are not willing to pressure the industry to do the things they need to do. We know that it's not the highway and the railroad. We know it's the industry. Three of the nation's 10 most polluted schools are in that corridor. We've seen, you know, former Democrats get jobs as public relations for, like, the castings plant in Berkeley. Mm. We need to understand that the officials are telling us one thing, but when it's time to actually make a change and pressure the industries, it's not happening. I'll take an answer on the air. Thanks.
All right, thank you. According to ENE News, Eloy Garcia, a partner at KP Public Affairs in Sacramento, works as a lawyer for the oil and gas lobby. Henry Pereira, who is a senior VP of policy, was a former Democratic Assembly member. And then former Senator Michael Rubio, a Democrat, is now a Chevron lobbyist. E&E has a piece that you can find at Your Call Radio. Businesses spent millions lobbying before cap and trade vote. What about that, Adam?
Well, I'm the money talks, and they are the biggest spender in Sacramento. And I want to make a point, though, that I think is important. There were two progressive Democrats who voted against this bill. That was Assemblymember Mark Stone of Santa Cruz and Assemblymember Monique Limon of Santa Barbara, who both thought it was not a deal they could support, and we want to commend them for that. Everybody was under a lot of pressure, especially from the governor, to support this bill, and that pressure game is felt by legislators who are threatened, that they're worried their other bills are not going to get signed, and sometimes that pressure, it's hard to overcome. I think it speaks, and the caller's point is right, I mean, it speaks to the need to have elected officials who are independent, who are going to be primarily accountable to their constituents, to the people, and not necessarily the party and the party leadership and where that money is coming from. We need more legislators in Sacramento who are accountable to their constituents, who are free of corporate money, who are willing to take on the industry, and we don't have enough of that right now. And the Democrats have a monopoly on politics. Obviously, the Republicans are very weak in California, are not very viable. As a result, a lot of the corporate cash is flowing through the Democrats. We just saw this with the single payer, the holdup there. So we need to have more elected officials, including in the Bay Area, who are going to fight these fights.
Can I, Quentin, add to that? Go ahead.
Okay. So as I stated earlier, I have a lot of respect for Food and Water Watch, and I have a lot of respect for Adam and the work that they do. But this kind of rhetoric is exactly, in my opinion, part of the problem. And you know what I want to illustrate for your callers is and be clear to articulate is, you know, the avoidance of this us versus them kind of mentality that sometimes begins to take root in our political rhetoric and how we view one another. This is not the Environmental Defense Fund versus EJ groups. This is not some member of the Democrats in the Assembly versus the two progressive members who did abstain and not vote for this policy. There are a lot of Democrats in the State House right now who are not beholden to oil interests or gas interests who supported this bill and who believe that the challenge of not doing nothing can far create further damage down the road than there is of creating a deal that actually moves the ball forward on addressing climate change and doing what's in the best interest of all Californians, which is why you saw this done as a packaged deal that did include air quality provisions we would never have gotten short of having that conversation in the context of this debate. And so I really want to illustrate, you know, for your members and for your callers to avoid that kind of rhetoric of us versus them, progressive versus mod. It's not about that. At the end of the day, we have one planet. And if we don't step up and do what's exactly in our best interest and in our ability to do, then we're all going to suffer for it, no matter where you live, no matter if you're Democrat or Republican, no matter if you live on the coast or in the urban community or the rural community. If we don't set the model and the example for other states and for the world to take action when what we see happening in Washington, D.C. right now is rolling back some of the progress that we have made, then we will not only have disappointed and failed ourselves with a lot of the political rhetoric that does nothing, we will not have made the necessary adjustments and the changes necessary to ensure that our quality of life for our children and for our children's children can continue to get better over time as we move forward. And that is what a lot of Democratic members in the legislature looked at, the bigger picture, and was not willing to sacrifice the perfect for the good.
Adam?
Well, I get that that is the PR of the passage of this bill, but let me just be very real and to his point about if we're going to save this planet, the us versus them is the people versus the oil and gas industry. And I respect Quentin, but the Environmental Defense Fund has a history. It's well known. They believe in partnering with industry. They have supported fracking regulations where other organizations have called for a ban. And that is their MO, and that's what the role they choose to play. But if we're going to be serious about reducing our pollution, we're going to have to take on the oil and gas industry and not let them help write the regulations with respect to pollution in California. So that is the approach we are taking with respect to this.
Well, thank you for calling in, Mark. I want to make sure we get a few more calls before we end. Let's hear from Vivian in Berkeley. Hi, Vivian. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. I appreciate the Food and Water Watch opposing this. And I feel like the big problem is that we act like CO2 is the same as other toxics. I think that should be, you know, that's kind of, it's conflated as like a toxin. You know, CO2 is only actually a toxin if you believe in the view of climate change. But it's not really a toxin compared to, like, these things that are being emitted that are causing asthma and terrible health problems for people in these communities. And I wish that Food and Water Watch would distinguish between the two. I mean, I know you may believe that CO2 is a pollutant, but if it is, it's a lot different, you know. And I also think that a lot of people think that our climate is being changed by geoengineering, you know. It maybe isn't CO2.
Well, let me just ask on your point about people suffering because of this. Quentin, we don't have much time, so if you can respond briefly, we'd appreciate it. If you look at what's happening with children, I mean, a lot of children in California have very unhealthy levels of asthma attacks, cardiovascular damage. And 2013 was the first year that cap and trade was in full operation. And yet here we are today, and people in the Central Valley still face severe health issues due to air pollution. So what about that and just the justice part of it? Because I mean, when you look at Richmond, 80% of the people living within a mile of that Chevron refinery are people of color who have just so many health problems.
Right. So I appreciate the question. I appreciate the caller raising it. So two things. One, in terms of the difference of CO2 and the difference of Crater and Tassa, she's absolutely right. There isn't a one-to-one kind of relationship between the two, and in fact we know that those particular matter and criteria and toxics actually do more harm in those communities than does CO2. And so the way that you have to address them also has to be different as well. But I also want to speak to that point. So,
we only have 30 seconds.
Sure. I'm a person of color. I grew up in an environmental justice community. I grew up in Watts, Los Angeles, and I had asthma as a child growing up, and I understand firsthand the impacts of a lot of these adverse health impacts as it relates to climate pollution. The fact of the matter is that with the companion piece 617, there are things in that bill, provisions in that bill, that are going to go a long way during implementation to ensure that those health risks are mitigated. In fact, you had the American Lung Association very strongly support that part of the package because they believed that it's also going to create those health benefits that we've been fighting for and that many people want to see and have wanted to see for decades. So the option of, as my colleague just said, we'd prefer a bill not pass, that just wasn't an option because the fact of the matter is the people in those communities can't wait for our politics to get figured out in order to get the relief that they need. Here was an opportunity to do that and provide those provisions and give the air districts and even the environmental justice communities laws on the books with which they could reference and actually begin to move the ball forward to bring that change.
Thank you. And let's get final thoughts from Adam. With Food and Water Watch.
The battle continues to get off of fossil fuels, stabilize the climate, and we're gonna continue. All the environmental justice groups oppose this bill. I think that speaks for itself.
Adam Scow is California Director of Food and Water Watch. They say that the cap-and-trade bill allows polluters to pay a fee to continue polluting the planet. Quentin Foster is Director of the Environmental Defense Fund's Global Climate Program. They say that the cap-and-trade program addresses local air pollution and pushes California businesses toward a cleaner economy. Adam and Quentin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you can read more about cap and trade at yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about a recent investigation in the East Bay Express that looked at the world of for-profit ambulance services and what they mean for the future of emergency care. What's behind the problems of low wages with few breaks for EMTs and paramedics, for example? We're going to be talking about our emergency medical response system and what happens when you call 911. That's tomorrow. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. If you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can leave us a review. If you have a show idea or a guest idea or would like to drop us a line, email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Sanaa Saleem produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us. It's Your Call.